Hi, I'm Mike.
Hey, I'm Kelsey. We're into telling you stories. Sometimes funny, sometimes awkward, sometimes creepy or sad, but who knows?
Every month it's different, but no matter what, you'll be asking yourself.
Okay, WTF.
Welcome, friends.
Here we are again, Mike.
We are here again at last.
It's exciting to have made it this far. Exciting. On this day of recording, I've heard a few things, as in we've made it through the 10 darkest days of the year. So I feel like an achievement for us. Granted, we'll be past that by the time this is live. But, you know, It's important to understand where you were in order to appreciate where you are. So by the time this comes out, you know, people will be in the light and this will all just be a distant memory.
You should make those motivational posters. I think maybe we need a OKWTF branded motivational posters to help our audience members get through the long days and nights.
They are long. They are. And I'm all for that. We need to figure out a merch situation. So, are you excited for your episode today?
So excited.
I heard you have a good one. So, I guess we can do a vibe.
Came here to win.
You came here to win. And I already feel like you're bringing the winning energy through the screen. So, I might as well just take the back seat, I think, at this point. I think if we do an episode, a story vibe check. Since I'll be going first, I'll give you the vibe check and then some context here. So the vibe check is unfortunate mishap, old. And the reason that this is something I was interested in is because of some different stuff I've been watching on Netflix. And so in particular, I believe the thing that I just watched was called Buried. Have you seen that?
I might have. I think I'm familiar with like the concept. I'm not sure if I've seen like a couple minutes of the first episode or not. I haven't like delved into it. I haven't unburied that show.
Okay. Oh, nice. Whoa. Nice one there. Whoa. So fell down a hole, watched that, got really into this whole, like, investigating the whole thing that it's related to, which we'll talk about in a second. But before I kind of dive in, I will say I got a whole bunch of resources from different places. HistoryLink, Wikipedia, of course. I feel like that should just be constantly there. Britannica, History.com, the Seattle Times, United States Ghost Towns, Wikipedia again, two different same Wikipedia thing twice because it was that important to my journey and only in your state. So thank you to all of these incredible articles. Of course, again, you can get all the resources in our show notes. So for my story, we're traveling back to the early 20th century. So it's a small town nestled in the Cascade Mountains of Washington State. So if you are not from the U.S., that is West Coast, Pacific Northwest. So just kind of imagine it's a pristine town, snow-capped peaks. You can hear the sound of steam trains chugging through the wintry landscape. Definitely a train mecca there. It's very picturesque. It was known for peaceful solitude and kind of that peaceful solitude interwoven with the triumph of this of human engineering focused on like trains and all of that. But I think we know that history, since we spend so much time talking about things in history, often reminds us that nature can hold a power far beyond our control. So have you heard the story of the Wellington Avalanche?
I have to be honest, no. Not one bit. This is a new story for me.
Well, so if you haven't gathered, Buried, I believe is what the series is called, is about an avalanche that happened, I I think it's Buried. Oh man, I think it's that. There's a few different series and things that my husband and I were watching, but one of them was focused on something that happened in Utah.
Okay.
An avalanche that happened in Utah, and that got me kind of spinning down the hole. So then I was like, well, what are some of the avalanches that's happened in the US? And then it was like, what's the deadliest avalanche ever, which is not in the US? But it did bring up that the Wellington avalanche is the deadliest avalanche in American history, a tale of survival and tragedy, and how a single natural event can leave an indelible mark on a community and ultimately an industry. So we're going to kind of paint a little picture of the world in which this whole thing occurred first. The year is 1909, and the world is really rapidly changing, right? It's the Industrial Revolution is at its peak. The U.S. is now crisscrossed with networks of railroads. They often called them iron horses, which I thought was really funny and so weird. I've never heard that before, especially, and just mostly in my brain, I'm thinking of like the body of a train with the legs of a horse, and it just makes me laugh.
Yeah.
So, and these were really the lifelines of America, bringing people and goods, you know, across this massive distance. And so nestled in the heart of these mountains, again, was this town in the Cascade Mountains in Washington State, was Wellington, very small town. It was a key location for the Great Northern Railway, which was a major transcontinental railroad. But Wellington wasn't just like any random stop along the track. It was strategically located near the summit of the Cascade Range. And that made it a critical point for train crossing, kind of train crossing the treacherous mountain pass that existed there. So it's quite an engineering feat to even build this out, to be honest. You can kind of see in one of the images here on the screen, there's, again, in our PowerPoint, you can find images, but we've got some of the town nestled in the mountains in like a valley, and then there's kind of this precarious train that spans a point of that mountain. The winter of 1909 to 1910 was not really an ordinary winter. The people of this area have always been used to snow, but this particular winter was quite different. The snow was really relentless, and it buried the town under, and the tracks of the train as well, under like a really thick, suffocating blanket of white snow. So the snowfall during that period was record-breaking. And a lot of the people from the time said that they just felt like it never would stop, and that blizzards were frequent, but when the snow was falling at such a tremendous rate, the risk of avalanches were ever present at that point.
Right.
So scary times. And at the same time, with the risk of the avalanches, because of trains at that point being so critical for commerce, communication, keeping them open was essential. Like there was no other kind of possibility per people, at least, right? And the heavy snowfall would kind of frequently block the tracks. So I have on the screen some images of snow, like, you know, people would have to be out there really shoveling the tracks off, like at all hours of the day. And it was really nutty. Like there would be times where there'd be so much snow, the passengers and crew just had to sit on the train and just kind of either wait for the weather to clear, or for all of these people to essentially shovel the snow away and open the pass so that the train could move. One of these days in particular, after all of this relentless snow, these passengers and crew and the people who were working the train clearly didn't know that they were kind of just waiting and clearing in the shadow of this kind of catastrophe that was really going to change the course of history for this town forever. So as we kind of leave the background of this, keep in mind, again, that the harshness of this winter and the general isolation of this town, because it really sets the stage for what's coming next, which was what they said at the time was a natural disaster of unimaginable proportions. So, yes, I know. So in the days leading up to the fateful first day of March, so March 1st in 1910, Wellington was again engulfed in this relentless winter storm. They were, you know, hoping for the skies to clear up, stop being buried in all of the snow. It was relentless. They were working day and night. So we're focusing on these critical days. The snow was piling up, the Great Northern Railway found itself in probably one of the most dire situations it was in. Two of its trains, the Spokane Express passenger train and a fast mail train, were both trapped on that kind of Cascade Mountain pass at the base of the mountain. The snow had rendered the tracks impossible, and these trains were totally stranded, and the workers, honestly, were unable to clear the snow as fast as it was falling. So the passengers, of course, were trying to remain hopeful. The workers were definitely weary, and the stay that they were kind of there ended up being what they called an extended stay. It was reported at the time that people were very tense because a lot of people, like the mail workers, were like, I got to get my mail going. Passengers were trying to get where they were needing to go. And people said, you know, it was communal, as in everyone was in this together, but the mood was clearly quite tense. But there were people, you know, sharing stories, playing cards, trying to keep each other's spirits up, while some were very, very aware of the danger that was kind of looming outside. They were there for days trying to forge a path. And the accumulation was becoming astronomical, and this kind of foreboding continued. So every snowflake at this point felt just kind of like a ticking time bomb. Really, I just like try to think about what I would feel in that moment. Like, I'm not sure if I would be totally aware of the idea of an avalanche, I guess. I don't know. In 1910, they wouldn't have had so much access to, like, I don't know. I just... ultimately, they're at the mercy, right, of whatever's going to happen. Yeah. So it was really, really late on March 1st, so going back March 1st, and suddenly a rumble kind of slowly, softly started. It was almost imperceptible at a point in time. They said it sounded like a low growl from the depths of the mountain, which I almost felt like was an explanation for what you might assume like a volcano it's initially sound like, but right. You know, there were some passengers and crew who were on the passenger train who started to sense something that was amiss because of the vibration. And they mentioned a shift in the air that happened in just like within seconds. What they said was almost an instant. The night was totally shattered by a deafening roar. And that roar was really the sound of millions of tons of snow breaking free from the mountainside, hurling toward the town of Wellington, with essentially an unstoppable force. So, of course, imagine the sheer terror of that moment. You're stranded, everyone's stranded. The avalanche struck with such power that it swept the trains from their tracks as if they were mere toys. So before I kind of go in here, there's an image on the screen of the Cascade Mountain and where the location of the train was at the time along that pass, the railroad line, where the town of Wellington was. And then the path of the avalanche was massive, but it basically, the avalanche directly went straight down to where the location of the train was and where a snow shed was that was built a year after this accident. So yeah, these trains were just flown right off of the tracks, just like they were toys. The Spokane Express, the passenger train, and the fast mail train were completely engulfed in a tidal wave of snow, ice, and debris. It honestly took seconds, they said, but it caught everybody that was in its path. So in the aftermath, the scene was utter devastation. So on the screen, I've got kind of an image of just a totally mangled train here from that time when this happened. And then next to it was an initial newspaper article that claimed there were 39 dead and 27 saved in the horror at Wellington. That will shift, but like you could tell that these newspapers were trying to put out any information they could get at the time, but it's really, really hard to move tons of snow. So often you don't know what you're really dealing with until you can do that. So it was complete chaos and destruction. These trains were buried under these heaps of snow. There was twisted metal, lots of broken trees. There were some survivors, and they emerged from this totally dazed and disoriented into something that was wildly unrecognizable. It's amazing that they survived, to be honest. But rescue efforts began pretty much immediately, and the conditions were absolutely brutal. So the snow continued to fall. The snow wasn't done falling. It was still absolutely a blizzard. Mm-hmm. And in that really seriously hampered the rescuers' efforts and really added to the urgency of finding any other survivors that couldn't make it out. And of course, every moment mattered. But the threat of an additional avalanche was, of course, in the back of their minds as well. So the Wellington avalanche was not really just a natural disaster, but ended up being a human tragedy. So initially we saw that they said like 36 lives were lost, but in reality, it was 96 people died that day. Families were torn apart and the town of Wellington was forever changed. So in just what was absolute seconds, those few terrifying moments, it just wiped away so much. So obviously nature, unpredictable. So the immediate aftermath, there was some glimmer of hope that was emerged because of the rescue effort. Even though it was a race against time, they did find, some passengers who were still alive, who had been injured or were trapped. And the rescuers ultimately were a mix of railway workers, local townspeople who found their way there, and eventually aid from neighboring communities. And just the snow kept falling. But these people were determined. So from a rescue effort perspective, these people were rescuing with truly just their bare hands, shovels, and lanterns. They didn't have any other resources available to them. No one could get up there unless you were living right nearby. Of course, they were finding bodies as they were doing this, which was just profoundly horrific. But they really braved so much, including a passenger who apparently was a doctor who tended to some of the injured and was ultimately played a very vital role in the survival of some of those who were found that were still alive. So the death toll is staggering and the recovery effort was long. Following the avalanche, so, you know, we've gotten through the rescue efforts, the digging out, all of this. Wellington became known for this and pretty much only this, right? And it was kind of now a town that was totally surrounded in just like horror. So they tried to rename the town from Wellington to Tye, I think, T-Y-E, an attempt to distance itself from this kind of tragedy. Yeah. And that didn't happen. There was a construction of a second Cascade Tunnel in 1929, rendering the original tunnel obsolete. And that tunnel was built in a totally different area, so not in that town. So that town that was such like a bustling hub before was no longer a bustling hub. They're like, we're not going to rebuild this at the site of the avalanche. So they rebuilt it. And then, of course, that old one became totally obsolete. And ultimately, when that new Cascade Tunnel was built, that kind of led to the demise of the old Wellington, New Tye, or whatever that town is. And even crazier is, I guess, like if you think the opposite of snow or ice would be fire.
Fire also.
Yeah, sure. Out of kind of what seemingly nowhere, a fire completely ravaged this town. So they suffered this avalanche. They tried to rebuild. They tried to rename. It didn't work out. They became obsolete. And then the fire ripped through their town and destroyed everything. And it just became nothing. So present day Wellington, it is accessible via the Iron Goat Trail near Stevens Pass out there. And it offers a really poignant kind of journey through time with this whole experience. So the trail leads adventurers through the remnants of the original town, including foundations, the tunnel entrance, miles of snow sheds, all of these things being kind of silent witnesses to the tragedy of this town. You know, because of the area and its unpredictable weather, you have to really plan carefully to go out there to see this historical significance, but you can actually go visit it. So, and the Iron Goat Trail is supposed to be quite serene and beautiful. But of course, there's a lot of melancholy associated with it, especially for those who are kind of descendants of people from that town. So visitors will often report a very heavy atmosphere, and it's almost as if the town's tragic past still lingers in the air.
Right.
So It's a must visit for those trying to seek a connection to history out there, experience a town lost to time, and to see the beautiful but unforgiving Cascade Mountains. But it is now truly a ghost town. And that is the story of the 1910 Wellington Avalanche.
Wow, that is great.
I know. It's totally wild. I was just like, I think the deadliest avalanche in the world was in maybe Nepal, I think it was. But that I was sense, like, yeah. You know, yeah, totally. And I was like, well, I wonder about the US though. And here we are. So this town doesn't even exist anymore, you know?
That's insane.
Snow. I know. And it wasn't like that long ago. You know what I mean? Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
What are the odds? So
that's crazy. Well, now we know.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy, crazy, crazy.
I know. Wild. Just, I never heard of that. So you
found out about this on that Buried show?
No, I was kind of like, I was watching this, and then kind of when I got obsessed with tsunamis a little while ago, I watched that documentary, and then I like fell down the hole of like, what are all the things related to tsunamis? So I watched the documentary about the avalanche, and then I was like, whoa, I wonder like what other places are prone to avalanches. And then in my searches, you know, I came across the deadliest avalanche in the world. And then I was like, well, that's the world. I wonder in the US, like I was thinking it would be like Utah. No, right. Wild. So
absolutely crazy. I love that. That says here is Death Hill, which sent tons of snow down on heads of helpless passengers. Oh my God.
Yeah. Death Hill. None can be alive now. I know after days of them searching, they, you know, of course they were like, the odds of people being alive are so slim. Yeah. And then just the fact that it's almost like you can't catch a break because you're desperately trying to uncover. And now you're uncovering not just snow, but like metal and trees and debris. And it's still relentlessly snowing. Like you cannot catch a break. So yeah. I mean, ghost towns are fascinating to me. So I'm always like, oh, I want to like go check it out, you know, and just like walk through and be like, because you know that at one point they were so bustling and this was a mecca. So it's just wild to think that
it
was so busy and then now it's just totally gone.
I would love to go to a ghost town.
I know. There's some interesting ones out there.
Yeah. One day we'll do a field trip.
We'll just do field trips to ghost towns. There's got to, I know. Well, oh my gosh, actually. Well, maybe I won't say any. No, I can't do another ghost town. I will say this. So if people want to go fall down a hill, there is a really interesting, I wouldn't say it's a ghost town, but it's an underwater town in Western Massachusetts. There used to be three towns actually, which are now what is called the Quabbin, which is the water source for Boston. But there used to be three towns that are underneath the Quabbin that are now filled in with water, and divers have, you know, done dives to kind of go and explore, and there's still foundations and all sorts of things down there. But that's a whole wild world too, underwater towns.
Yeah, that's a wild rabbit hole to go down.
Mm-hmm. So thank you for indulging me.
Oh please. Segue, we got Death Hill on the screen, which will lead me right into my vibe check. That's my story. My story, it takes place around a similar time. You had 1910. Mine is around 1917 through the 1920s and a little bit beyond then. Has to deal with some really heartbreaking occurrences. And it's primarily due to corporate greed and a lack of scientific understanding. But my story does have some content warnings, which I will put in the in the description for the episode, but there's going to be some more death. Some very descriptive. I don't know how to word it, but like decay, bodily decay.
Are you? And I have a guess.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I haven't seen. Are you talking about radium by chance?
I am indeed talking about radium.
Are you talking about radium girls?
I might indeed be talking about radium girls. Do you know anything about this topic?
I know a lot about it. I love Radium Girls, the book, and I watched the docuseries, and this is one of my favorite stories in terms of, like, exactly what you were just saying. Like, thinking about the terror of corporate greed. Everyone should know about this, and most people that I talk to do not. So I'm stoked that you are bringing more awareness.
Yeah. So I knew about the Radium Girls, the Radium Dial Painters, for a number of years now. But what really changed the game for me was the Radium Girls book, which I listened to. And actually, that kind of leads me into my sources. My number one source is Kate Moore's The Radium Girls, The Dark Story of America's Shining Women. I have to highly, highly recommend this.
Yes, she's the best author.
Yeah, and I listen to the audiobook just because that's how I tend to get most of my reading done these days. And the narrator was excellent too. I forget her name, but she was wonderful.
Kate Moore, I have to say. Also, sorry to interrupt you, but like...
No, good.
Just highlight on Kate Moore. Truly one of my favorite authors, writes some of the best books I've ever read related to what you're going to talk about in a second. And also there is a book that I tell everyone in the world about because I read it in 2 days. It was so good. And her books are not small, as you know, with Radiant Girls.
No, they're bulky.
Oh my gosh. It was called The Women They Could Not Silence. And we need to talk about that after because that book shook me. So anyway.
Yeah, that is, as soon as I finished this book,
I
looked up what else she had written, and I was like, adding. So, Kelsey and I are going to beat you over the head with this book recommendation. It is so powerful. It is heartbreaking. I was talking to Kelsey just before today and saying, like, it's been a week or two, and I still find myself... like just crying in the middle of the day because of what everyone went through and the way she describes like the lives of these women, you like get to intimately know them. Obviously I couldn't do like a really deep in-depth thing because we only have a limited number of time. My goodness. I like as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, find the book. Go to the library, get the book, get the audiobook, whatever works best for you. My goodness, absolutely read that. And then, of course, the obligatory Radium Girls. Unfortunately, Kelsey, I only have one instance of Wikipedia Radium Girls on here, not a second one. I do have Radium, but I don't have Radium Girls.
Well, clearly you don't care about it enough.
I guess not. I do have a link to... theradiumgirls.com, which is a companion website to Kate Moore's book, which is also incredible. And a few more articles. We have afacwa.org. We have medicalbag.com, environmentalhistory.org, the Library of Congress.gov, Harvard articles as well. So we're gonna get into this. It's gonna be if you're maybe not in the best place. Come back to it when you're ready to. It's pretty rough, but it is extremely important. Extremely important to, I think, just knowing what it means to exist and be a human.
And be a woman.
And be a woman, absolutely.
Completely ignored. Yes.
Constantly. And gaslit by corporations and men. Endlessly. So, it's the late 1910s, early 1920s. And there's a group of young women in New Jersey and Illinois who are embarking on what they believe to be a promising career in dial painting. There would be many women that would join, and there would be radium facilities throughout the United States, Connecticut, many places, but I'm going to hyper-focus on these two. And these women that I'm going to be talking about are Catherine Schaub, Grace Fryer, Molly Maggia, Quinta Maggia McDonald, Albina Maggia Larice, Edna Hussman, Ella Eckert, Sarah Carlo Mellifer, Marguerite Carlo, Irene Rudolph, Catherine Donaghy, Charlotte Purcell, Marie Rossiter, Ella Cruz, Peg Looney, Inez Vallette, Frances Glasinski O'Connell, Marguerite Glasinski, and Pearl Payne. These women, often in their late teens, early 20s, some as young as 14, were employed by companies like the United States Radium Corporation, which I'll henceforth call USRC in my story. And this was based in Newark in Orange, New Jersey, and the Radium Dial Company in Ottawa, Illinois. And they were hired to hand paint watch dials with luminous paint containing radium. Initially, this job seemed kind of glamorous, lucrative. They offered decent wages and got a kind of sense of independence for the young women in search of employment opportunities, especially where this was right around World War One, and most of the men were fighting. And so the companies needed workers, and these women were very, very hard workers. The women were excited to work with this luminous paint made up of finely ground radium, which they dubbed Liquid Sunshine, and the USRC trademarked as Undark. And on the screen here, I have a little leaflet about Undark, and I've kind of blown up to the manufacturers how they're kind of talking it up and saying everything's great about the whole thing. The women were paid per dial. Every dial they painted was a penny and a half at the time, which is just under 35 cents today. And could be expected to paint around 250 to 300 dials, earning them around $85 in 2022 bucks per shift. Factory workers often noted how the powder would get everywhere, in people's hair, all over their clothes, in their food. Many workers elected to eat their meals right where they were doing the painting, so that they could boost their own efficiency, paint more dials, get better pay, versus going out to eat for lunch or going into a separate room, like a break room or something. Some women were so happy with the work and the newfound finances that they would end up recruiting their own family members, which you might have heard when I was listing out all those women. A lot of very common surnames there, because most of them were siblings or related of some kind. So the women diligently applied to glowing paint for the watch dials, and they were unaware of the hidden dangers of radium. Radium itself was a newly discovered element in 1898 by Marie and Pierre Curie, which you can see on the screen there on the left-hand side. And it was celebrated for its like luminous properties and also it being highly radioactive. Unfortunately, the true hazards of radium exposure were not really fully understood at the time, with current belief being that the radium was only lethal in very high doses. There were some cases where there were some scientists that were like, pump the brakes on this. Like, we need to do way more research. But the majority of companies and doctors were all like, radium's the best. And they even had a term for it called radium mania. And here I'm going to quote from Kate Moore's book, The Radium Girls. Yet the flip side of the coin was all the positive literature about radium. As early as 1914, specialists knew that radium could deposit in the bones of radium users and that it caused changes in their blood. These blood changes, however, were interpreted as a good thing. The radium appeared to stimulate the bone marrow to produce extra red blood cells. Deposited inside the body, radium was the gift that kept on giving. But if you looked a little closer at all those positive publications, there was a common denominator. The researchers, on the whole, worked for radium firms. As radium was such a rare and mysterious element, its commercial exploiters, in fact, controlled to an almost monopolizing extent its image and most of the knowledge about it. Many firms had their own radium-themed journals, which were distributed free to doctors, all full of optimistic research. The firms that profited from radium medicine were primary producers and publishers of that positive literature. And on the screen here, I have a little leaflet I found about Radior, and it's all of, like, beauty products, just chock-a-block full of radium. So all these published studies were fueling this industry of radium, even though, like I had mentioned earlier, there were scientists that were trying to pump the brakes. Majority of them were fully bought off and paid for, and more than happy to get a few more dollars in their pocket, and who cared about anything
Always
else?
Always gotta check your sources, folks. Who's sponsoring Always. Your news, man? Oh,
yeah.
So, and I remember when they're saying, like, people would literally have ailments and they would say, oh, just take a radium bath. Imagine, imagine. Oh, God.
Yeah, there was one. So, there was a story in the book, I'm sure you remember, of like a tycoon. It was kind of like an Elon Musk type that would drink radium water like every single day.
Yes.
Yeah. Things didn't work out too well for him. But I'm going to focus on the women. The young women were not adequately informed of the risks associated with their work. The luminous paint was applied to the dials with fine-tipped camel hair brushes. However, USRC wanted each line to be precise. And as such, the tips of the brushes needed to be kept at a point. Using sponges or rags was time-consuming, reduced efficiency, and created excess waste. So the company came up with a process they called lip, dip, and paint. Basically, after a few strokes of the paint, the women would wet the tip of their brushes with their mouths, dip the brush in the radium paint, then apply it to the dials. When they would wet the brushes, there would be luminous paint residue, and they would ingest it. And just to remember for the audience, 250 dials per shift, constant ingesting of radium. When there was an abundance of paint, the women would paint themselves with it, their nails, their teeth, their hair, their eyebrows. And at night, they would cast a luminous ethereal glow while dancing or having fun with family and friends. Some women really enjoyed the taste of the paint. I'm not sure. I wouldn't even want to try it at all.
It's like the people who like the smell of gas, you know?
Hey, I don't mind the smell of gas. I get like, Amber is always like, oh, you like the smell of skunk. And sometimes I do. I don't know. I'm just a weirdo. But I don't think
you'd
I
like
would.
Radium, then.
I hope that's not an indicator. But I mean, the women didn't really know any better, and they trusted their workplace to kind of, they would expect to be told if there were any problems. So of course it's going to glow at night. They definitely want to, it's like the late 1910s, the 20s, the roaring 20s. Of course, you know, it all makes sense. Like, why? And yeah, it's just so heartbreaking coming from the modern viewpoint of like, no, stop.
No, don't do that. Yeah. Not worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Despite the seemingly innocuous nature of their work, the women soon began experiencing troubling health issues. Initially, they dismissed all of these ailments as minor inconveniences, attributing them to like common illnesses or the stresses of everyday life. However, as their symptoms worsened and mysterious illnesses began to plague their lives, they grew increasingly concerned about their well-being. Toothaches, jaw pain, inexplicable bone fractures became commonplace among many of the dial painters, casting a shadow of uncertainty on their once promising careers. Unknown to the women, the root of their suffering lay in the effects of the radium poisoning from ingesting all the radium from the paint. The radioactive substance ingested through years of lip pointing and direct contact with the paint wreaked havoc on their bodies, causing severe damage to their bones and their internal organs. Despite their deteriorating health, the companies responsible for their problems remained indifferent to their issues, prioritizing profits over the well-being of their employees. As the women continued to work, the true extent of the health effects caused by radium exposure began to emerge. Like I mentioned earlier, the jaw pain, the toothaches, there was fatigue. As time passed, their conditions deteriorated rapidly and more severe symptoms manifested. One of the most harrowing consequences of radium poisoning was the development of necrosis in the jaw bones of the affected women. This condition, known as radium jaw or radium necrosis, resulted from the radioactive decay of radium within the bones of the women themselves, leading to the deterioration of bone tissue and excruciating pain. Many of the women suffered from disfiguring facial deformities and had to undergo multiple painful surgeries and futile attempts to alleviate their suffering. I'm going to quote again from Kate Moore's Radium Girls. Radium, they noted, had a similar chemical nature to calcium. Thus, radium, if absorbed, might have a preference for bone as a final point of fixation. Radium was what one might call a bone seeker, just like calcium. And the human body was programmed to deliver calcium straight to the bones to make them stronger. Essentially, the radium had masked itself as calcium and fooled the girls' bodies into depositing it inside their bones. Radium was a silent stalker, hiding behind that mask, using its disguise to burrow deep into the woman's jaws and teeth. On the screen, I have a picture of radium jaw here. I cannot imagine the pain that they went through.
Oh, some of the things that Kate Moore explains are just like, just like with teeth and it's horrific.
Yeah, I'm going to be going into one of those in a few paragraphs here, but it only gets worse from here. Furthermore, the radioactive properties of radium wreaked havoc on the women's internal organs, causing widespread damage to their bone marrow, liver, and kidneys. As the radium accumulated in their bodies, it emitted harmful radiation that disrupted normal cellular function, leading to an array of debilitating illnesses and conditions. Despite their youth and vitality, remember, these women are still in their teens. They're in their early 20s. The women were slowly and agonizingly consumed by the toxic effects of radium poisoning. Amidst all of this, the escalating health crisis faced by the women, the companies responsible for these issues remained indifferent to their suffering. USRC, the Radium Dial Company, the Waterbury Clock Company, and others like them, all they cared about was profit. And they would employ deceitful tactics to conceal the dangers of radium exposure and evade accountability, to the extent of hiring their own dentists or doctors to go and obfuscate, make the women more confused. One doctor was saying, I think it might have something to do with your occupation. And then they'd go see the doctor that USRC had paid for and say, no, here's all this literature that radium is just fine. Have more of it. It must be something else in your life that you're doing that is causing this.
Yeah, all hundreds of us. Absolutely. That makes total sense.
The first of the women to pass was Molly Maggia, who in 1922 choked to death in her own blood as her mouth and throat hemorrhaged. Earlier that year, she had sought out a dentist due to intense jaw pain. While carefully examining her jaw, the dentist was horrified when part of her jaw broke off in his hands. It was so deteriorated that part of her jaw came free just by slightly lifting her chin. Instead of implementing safety measures to protect their workers, the companies actively misled the women about hazards of their work and suppressed information about the health risks associated with radium. And this was all the way to the top. They ignore warnings from medical professionals and disregarded evidence linking radium exposure to the alarming increase in illnesses among their employees. Moreover, they exploited the trust and vulnerability of these young women, coercing them to continue working under hazardous conditions without regard for their health and safety. The corruption at the heart of these companies extended beyond their treatment of women to their interactions with regulatory authorities and legal institutions. They used their money and influence to obstruct investigations into the health effects of radium exposure, manipulated public perception, and evaded legal responsibility for the harm inflicted upon their employees. In doing so, they perpetuated a toxic culture that allowed them to prioritize money over the lives and well-being of their workers. Despite facing enormous obstacles, the women refused to remain silent in the face of injustice. Their courageous fight for justice would culminate in a series of historic lawsuits that exposed the incredible misconduct of the companies and paved the way for significant legal reforms in the realm of workplace safety and employee rights. The Radium Girls' quest for justice began with individual lawsuits filed by some of the afflicted women against the companies responsible for their suffering. These early legal battles faced so many challenges, including formidable legal teams and resources gathered by the corporations, as well as the lack of established legal precedent for cases involving occupational disease caused by toxic substances. Up until this point, there were only a few substances that were under the law of occupational diseases that you could even claim any kind of suit from. And a lot of these even had like terms. They had limits of up to 2 years. But the way that radium worked was year after year after year was cumulative. It is not something that would happen that you would find out about within 2 years. So the laws needed to change, but everything was fighting against these women to get the laws to change. Despite these challenges, the women and their lawyers persevered, marshaling compelling evidence and expert testimony to support their claims. Their lawsuits brought to light the extent of the company's negligence and malfeasance, exposing a deliberate suppression of information about the dangers of radium and the disregard for the health and safety of their employees. And I have on the screen here a few snippets that I was able to find of newspapers talking about some of the women and what they had to deal with. It was around this time that doctors started to understand that this was something that would be incurable. Up until this point, these women were under the impression that if they went to the doctor, went to the dentist, got all these surgeries and procedures performed, that maybe they could return to their normal life. And that was not the case. On the far end, there is, sorry, I'm getting a little emotional. On the far end, there is a clipping of one of the major landmark decisions. The person writing there is the judge, who up until this point, many of the judges had been kind of somehow involved with the Radium Corporations or had taken money or were on the board of directors or something where there was a conflict of interest. And they would rule, of course, very little for the women and mostly in favor of the Radium Corporations. But that was one such judge who, just, this was in Illinois, basically like, no, you're being idiots. Very clearly, all the evidence is pointing towards you being negligent. And that is Catherine Donaghy laying down on her couch with her lawyer and a few of her friends nearby, and her husband is sitting there too. And he is writing to make sure that at least the Radium Girls in Illinois have some kind of coverage. One of the most significant legal victories for the women came in the form of a groundbreaking ruling by the Illinois Supreme Court in 1939 in the case of Dial versus Radium Dial Company. The court ruled in favor of the plaintiffs, establishing a crucial precedent that held corporations accountable for the health consequences of their actions. This landmark decision marked a turning point in the fight for workplace safety and employee rights, setting the stage for broader legal reforms and regulatory oversight of hazardous working conditions. And I should note, with things starting to turn, with the tide starting to turn against these corporations, they only doubled down, and they would just basically like, all right, fine, we're going to appeal that, and we're going to appeal that, and we're going to appeal that, and hope they were hoping that they could just keep appealing and getting continuances so that maybe these women would die before they could get any kind of claim for everything that they had suffered through. As the legal battles of the Radium Girls gained traction, their stories captured the attention of the public and sparked widespread outrage and sympathy. Newspapers and media outlets across the country covered their plight, exposing the injustices they faced and rallying support for their cause. Public pressure mounted on government officials and regulatory agencies to take action against these companies responsible and enact measures to protect workers from similar hazards. The women themselves became powerful advocates for workplace safety and employee rights, sharing their experiences and speaking out against the injustices they endured. Their courage and resilience inspired a wave of activism and advocacy, galvanizing labor unions, women's groups, and social reformers to demand accountability from corporations and push legislative reforms to safeguard workers' health and safety. And here we have Quinta McDonald, Edna Hussman, Albina Maggia, Catherine Schaub, and Grace Fryer. And this was on June 4th, 1928. So just about 11 years before that landmark case of the Illinois Supreme Court. Unfortunately, some of the women pictured there did not live to see that day. In response to mounting public pressure, lawmakers introduced legislation aimed at strengthening workplace safety regulations and improving oversight of hazardous industries. These efforts culminated in the passage of landmark laws such as the Occupational Safety and Health Act. We know that as OSHA. This was in 1970, which established enforceable standards for workplace safety and empowered workers to speak out against unsafe conditions without fear of retaliation. It's amazing to me that it's something that we kind of take for granted. We see the, or at least where I have worked in the past, we see the bulletins and the pamphlets up on a cork board, and we're like, OSHA, okay, we can't mix this paint with that paint. But really, it's so much deeper than that, and it's so important, and it's like nothing we're ever taught. And the fact that the women were going through all of this and still had the strength to stand up and fight for all of us when at different points in history, there were people who didn't believe them or thought that they were just trying to gather attention and get more money. It's insane to me. The legacy of the Radium Girls extends far beyond their individual struggles and legal victories. Their stories continue to serve as a potent reminder of the human cost of corporate greed and the importance of holding corporations accountable for their actions. Moreover, the women's legacy lives on in the ongoing fight for social justice and environmental protection, inspiring activists and advocates to challenge corporate power at every turn and advocate for policies that prioritize the well-being of workers and communities over profits. Their courage, resilience, and determination in the face of adversity serve as a beacon of hope and inspiration for future generations as they continue to strive for a more just and equitable society. The tragic experiences of the women also contributed to significant advances in the medical research and scientific understanding of the effects of radiation exposure on the human body. These cases brought attention to the dangers of radium and other radioactive substances, leading to increased research into their health effects and the development of safer workplace practices and regulations. Medical professionals and researchers studying the Radium Girls case gained valuable insights into the mechanisms of radiation poisoning and its long-term health consequences. Their findings helped refine diagnostic techniques and treatment protocols for radiation-related illnesses, leading to improved outcomes for patients suffering from similar conditions. Furthermore, the women's experience served as a cautionary tale about the importance of rigorous scientific research and evidence-based policy making in addressing public health risks. Their cases highlighted the need for comprehensive regulatory frameworks and workplace safety standards to protect workers and ensure their health and well-being. Here I've put together a timeline of sorts, and I started it at 1898 when radium was discovered. When the women first started working at USRC and the Radium Dial Company in Ottawa, and also the many unfortunate and unforgivable deaths. So I would ask you to please take a look. Despite the passage of time, the memory of the Radium Girls lives on as a poignant reminder of the human cost of corporate greed and the power of grassroots activism to effect change. Their stories continue to resonate with people around the world, like Kelsey and me, and maybe you now, inspiring new generations to advocate for justice, accountability, and workplace safety. In recent years, efforts to honor the legacy of the women have gained momentum with memorials, exhibitions, and educational initiatives dedicated to preserving their memory and raising awareness about all of their contributions to the fight for social justice. These efforts ensure that the sacrifices of the Radium Girls are never forgotten and that their struggles remain a beacon of hope and inspiration for the future. Radium Girls are a powerful testament to the resilience, courage, and determination of ordinary individuals in the face of extraordinary adversity. Their fight for justice against corporate negligence and exploitation has left an indelible mark on American history and continues to inspire all of us to stand up for what is right. Catherine Schaub, Grace Fryer, Molly Maggia, Quinta Maggia McDonald, Albina Maggiolaris, Edna Hussman, Ella Eckert, Sarah Carlo Malfer, Marguerite Carlo, Irene Rudolph, Catherine Donaghy, Charlotte Purcell, Marie Rossiter, Ella Cruz, Peg Looney, Inez Vallet, Frances Glasinski O'Connell, Marguerite Glasinski, Carol Payne, and terribly many more. Let's do our best to honor these women and all of the bullshit they had to deal with. These women who refused to back down in the face of adversity and injustice. Remember these luminous beings, not because of the radium, but because they are beacons of the best of humanity. And that's my story.
Oh, Mike, that was such an incredible summary of a very difficult, deep, dark, very real history.
Yeah.
And we're talking like this person on the end, Pearl, right? Pearl Payne died in 1998, lived with radium poisoning her whole life, and died when I was 11. Yeah. You know what I mean? I was basically approaching teenagerdom. And this woman suffered for that long. And so people are like, this happened so long ago. It's like, nah, not really though. Like, this wasn't that long ago. Many the people who are listening girl. To this were alive. Yeah.
Yeah. The last radium girl, I forget her name, but she worked at the Waterbury Clock Company. Mm. She only just passed away in 2014.
Wow.
And it's crazy. So you do see a lot of names very early on, right? So if you didn't get the radium poisoning that infiltrated your jaws, mm-hmm. broke apart your bones from the inside out, so much so that you couldn't walk anywhere, and yet these women still showed up to courtrooms mm-hmm. and did everything they could. If you didn't have that, then in 5, 10, 15 years, you'd start developing abscesses. Incredibly horrific growths on their joints, on their knees. Mm. It was carcinomas and just a life filled with pain. There was never not pain for these women.
Yeah. Emotional, physical, all of it. Financial. I remember thinking through the financial impact of this. We're talking how long it took for some of these families to be even partially provided any layer of support after having to go through so much medical trauma. Like, these families were struggling significantly financially on top of all of the trauma of losing family, of dealing with pain, and it was just like piled on, and these companies did not care.
Yeah, did not care and obfuscate and cloud everything. With Molly Maggia, they didn't know really about radium poisoning at the time, so they just tested for everything under the sun, and somehow syphilis showed up. So on her death certificate, syphilis was there. And so these companies, or USRC in this case, would be like, look, she died because of syphilis. It was nothing that we had to do, nothing we were involved in. And they would just like parade it. There was in the book, I think it was Peg Looney, and I apologize if I'm getting this wrong, in Illinois, she died in a company hospital.
and the family wanted an autopsy, and the company told the doctor an hour later than what the autopsy was being performed at, and they even took her bones so that this the family doctor couldn't test for radium poisoning. And it just, I remember through this whole book thinking like, God, and some people get excited about company towns. Like, that's a whole other podcast, right? About like Henry Ford and all that crap. But like, people are like, yeah, these company towns would be great. Everything would be centrally located. And it's like, no, it's not great. Like, they control everything. They control all the information, all of the resources. It's just, read the book. Read Kate Moore's book, The Radium Girls. Listen to it. Your life will change. So did I win the award?
Oh, of course you won the award. This is such a powerful story, and I could not agree more. Read the book. Watch the movies. There's documentaries about it. Read anything Kate Moore writes. But this is really a dark reminder of kind of the plight of a woman. And many women who still experience similar, like what you were saying before, gaslighting and just hit incompetence at every turn for any number of reasons, whether it's related to medical incompetence or financial incompetence or just like general rights for women, and how I just think about the strength of a woman to be suffering so intensely and still fight so hard. And if that doesn't explain a woman every day, I don't know what does. To be a woman is to suffer and to fight every day. Like, every day. Just your existence is a fight against something. And I just, this is just like a stark reminder of that. And so it's wild to me in thinking like, this wasn't that long ago. It is still history. We always say, don't let history repeat itself. And yet when it comes to women, when it comes to women identifying anybody, when it comes to disability, there are just certain subgroups or groups of underrepresented people where history doesn't seem... It doesn't seem to click that yeah. The repeating the might not be, touch. We might yeah. not be, you know, using radium in the same way, but it doesn't have to be radium for it to be a reflection. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's the part.
Insert X.
Yes. Like, radium could yeah. be recycled for a different word there. And yet people really struggle with that concept that like, oh, well, it's not, we don't have radium girls anymore. It's not, but you've got all this stuff going on here. So,
all yeah. the nouns, all the yeah. noun girls.
And man, just women are so strong. I just think about like mentally, emotionally, just the constant shit that gets piled on us. And yet we persevere for some reason. We do. But you know, you did an incredible job summarizing a very difficult, complicated yeah. history. Yeah. Mike, you've really just definitely got to read The Woman They Could Not Silence. Oh my yeah. gosh.
Oh, yeah. That is that on my wish list.
Oh, that book is I read Radium Girls first, then I read another book that she like ghost wrote for okay. someone. It was like someone who was like a detective who this was a long time ago. Like, I think I read Radium Girls in like maybe like 20. Oh gosh. Whenever I came back to this area. So like 9 years ago, maybe 9 or 10 years ago. And then a couple of years after that, read that detective one. But just about a year and a half ago is when it's about 2 years ago is when I read The Woman They Could Not Silence. In 2 days, I was on a work trip and I would wake up at 5 a.m. and sit in the breakfast place and read through it, because, and I'd be right back there at night. Like I said, no, I can't go out. I got to go home. I need sleep. But I just wanted to read it because it was like on my mind. And it is another example of exactly what we're talking about. Insert X for the plight of women, because it's a whole other ball game of absolute disgusting, atrocious behavior of men and legal loopholes and just, oh goodness, if this made you sad, that will also. So beware, but persevere, because it's worth it.
And all the women had to anyways, and still do.
Yes, truly. Yeah. I mean, Mike, you, of course, win this award. This is all yours, my friend. I don't care what anyone else says. The vote doesn't go out.
A man won the award on the backs of all these women.
Well, let's be real. These women won the award.
They won the award. I will
happily. Via you. Via you were the, what is it? The, like, because the they could conduit. Not be here. Yes, the conduit. So they won the award via you.
Well, I dedicate this award to all of them and all women everywhere.
Yay, we love it. So I win.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, by proxy, you win.
By proxy. No. Oh, man. Yeah, I'll be really, really curious. Like, if you've read this book.
If anyone's read this book, like, talk to us about the parts that hit you. If you, we just basically started a book club.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking that. I was like, should we start a book club and do the buy me a coffee, which I'll talk about in a second, where if you pay a little extra, you can be a part of our book club. I think that might be an option here.
That's a pretty good idea. Maybe we can like go back through our previous episodes and see if there are any good books. Or maybe if any of our listeners have listened and been like, yeah, I read a really good book about that before. Mm-hmm. They should tell us about it. And maybe this is like an informal book club thing.
This should be a book club thing, and perhaps that will be available for a certain member tier, because we're introducing this thing called Buy Me a Coffee. If you have been enjoying listening to our episodes, now you've probably heard almost 10 of them or more. You know, we put a lot of heart and soul into these things. We put a lot of work into this. You know, we're running this all on our own. We don't have sponsorships to do this. So if you've enjoyed listening, yourself,
Kelsey.
The man has the sponsorship, of course.
Yep.
Greed. No. But if you have been listening, you're like, I really enjoy this. Help us keep going. We, you know, pay for everything out of our own pockets in terms of our podcast hosting platform, our website, all of that stuff. And we love it and we do it. But if you're out there and you're like, yeah, I really like this, I want to see them keep going, like, let us know. Buy us a coffee. We're adding the Buy Me a Coffee link to our social media. If you feel so inclined, of course, keep listening regardless. But if you feel inclined and you would like to, check it out on our social media links. We'll put it on our website. It will also be a link in the notes along with all the other links of the episode. So so if you feel so inclined, and just maybe Mike and I will start a little book discussion as an extra thing, and we'll tell you about that if we do, and we'll record those, maybe record those in with actually the video and post them somewhere.
Yeah, that would be fun.
For folks, if they decide that the Buy Me a Coffee route feels good. So, you know, if you're out there listening and you feel inclined, go for it. Either way, the best way to support is to leave comments on our social media, to rate, subscribe, share it with your friends if you like it. The more people that know about it too, the more things that come our way in terms of topics and things people are curious about or interested. So, Mike, if they want to do that, where can they do that?
There's so many good places to do that. And I was going to say that we do not like expect
But if you can't do any of that stuff, any of that extra stuff, you just reach out to us, comment on our stuff, give us new new ideas for stories, new ideas of like great books. You can email us at hello@okwtfpodcast. You could also go to many of our socials, which would have the tag okwtfpodcast on that as well. You can submit your own stories. That would be a great way to support us. You can go to our website, www.okwtfpodcast.com. There'll be a link up there where you could be like, hey, I have this really crazy story, or I know this great story that Kelsey and Mike should do, or I know this great book that Kelsey and Mike should read. Send it there.
Tell us.
Email us. Social media. Do all the things. We love you.
We love you. We love that you listen. It's what keeps us going. We love looking at the stats. But we also want to hear from you. So let us know what's up. And Mike, it's been a pleasure.
It's been glorious. Wait, it's been luminous.
Luminous.
No, it's been illuminating. I like that one the most.
Illuminating. It has been quite illuminating across the board. And cheers to history, hopefully one day actually not repeating itself for the worst reasons.
Here's the women being in charge.
We're on it. We're working on it. Except at the same time, I'm like, we have enough to do.
It's also true.
Don't put us in charge too.
Not having to take all the responsibility for everything either.
Dogs, step up. We need dogs, cats, and power.
Cats. Empowered cats and dogs.
Yeah, they've really been living the high life. Anyway, it's always a pleasure. It's such a joy, Mike, and I'm so looking forward to next time.
Me too. Can't wait.
Thanks for getting weird with us.
Submit your own OKWTF stories for us to share by visiting www.okwtfpodcast.com.
And stay in touch on all the social platforms at OKWTF Podcast.
Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to OKWTF on your streaming service of choice.
Thank you so much to Out of Flux and Eyal Talmudi for the use of their song, Da Boom Jiggle.
And thank you to Bilal Sarwar for their incredible cover art.
Until next time.